you just tuned into the hippest way to start and grow your indie author career. Learn the ins, the outs, and all the all-arounds of self-publishing with the team from D2D and their industry-influencing guests. You're listening to Self-Publishing Insiders with Draft2Digital.
Hello and welcome to Draft2Digital Spotlight. This is Mark Leslie Lefebvre from Draft2Digital. You can also call me Mark2Digital. And I have someone else with three names, but he's way cooler than me. I have Dean Wesley Smith here. Dean, thanks for joining me here today.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's going to be fun.
It's great to have you, to hang out with you. I guess the last time we were just hanging out in person together at one of the workshops that you guys teach in Vegas. So,
yeah, the anthology workshop.
Yeah, but I'm getting ahead of myself, because what I want to do for anyone who's not familiar with you is to take them back to the very early days and when you first got into writing, because there was a story you had shared with me that I found absolutely fascinating, and it was the very first story you sold. Can we go way back to those days? It was only a decade or two ago, right?
Yeah, I could mess with you and say I don't remember, but it was back in the 70s, 1974. And I had been writing poetry. Actually, it was, I think, 75. I'd been writing a lot of poetry and selling it, which was surprising me. I had no idea. I'd never wanted to be a writer. Hated to write anything. Hated to write essays or anything. And since I was selling poetry, I thought, well, I should try a short story. And I wrote one, mailed it off, and it sold. And I wrote another one and mailed it off, and it sold. And at that point, I'm thinking, well, you know, maybe I should learn how to be a writer. Yeah. And then I got into all of the really stupid rewriting myths. And you have to write slow and you have to do all of that stuff. And for 7 years, I didn't sell a thing. Didn't even get a personal rejection on anything because I was rewriting everything into you know, just nothingness. It was horrid. And I had slowed down to doing all the way to, you know, two short stories a year, where I think I wrote the first two that I sold in the space of overnight type of thing. And it just, it was my hard earned many years lesson before I finally, actually, it wasn't until 1982 that I found Heinlein's Rules on January 1st, 1982, and started following Heinlein's Rules, those five simple rules, which are very hard to follow, but I followed them. And that's when I started selling again.
Really?
Stopped rewriting.
For the audience who may not be familiar with Heinlein's Rules, what were the rules that you found most valuable within those five?
Well, actually, all five of them. You must write. That's number one. You must finish what you write. That's number two. That kills most people.
Those are two hard things right there.
Those are the two ones. Yeah. Number three is the you must not rewrite. Number four, you must put it on the market. And number five, you must keep it on the market. And Heinlein did those rules in 1946. Wow. And they are called his business rules. And he just, you know, and it's so simple. You must write. You must finish what you write. You must not rewrite. You must put it on the market. And you must keep it on the market.
So as someone who's been in the industry for as long as you have, obviously worked your way through many different phases of traditional publishing as well as indie publishing, it's amazing. It's like he wrote it last week. Yeah. You must keep it on the market. Let's talk a little bit about that, because I know that you've had that experience of having books that were traditionally published and then the rights reverted to you. How did you deal with that change in the industry?
Oh, it saved me, basically. I was burnt out on New York, mostly on all of the crap in New York. The lack of memory, no respect, nothing. I had done, I did 106 to my best count. There may be a couple more in there somewhere, but I've done 106 novels with traditional publishers.
Okay.
That is the New York big publishers. A lot of those were ghost books or media books under many, many, many pen names. I still haven't dug out all of my pen names that I wrote and published stories under. I just was burnt out. And so when the indie movement came along in, 2008, realized that in New York publishing, we were already tired of ebooks. We were starting to have meetings about ebooks in 1990, And it was always the sky is falling, it's going to ruin everything. Oh, and then it wouldn't, nothing would happen. I was on the bestseller. In fact, I was number one on the electronic bestseller list in the year 2000. I think it was Rocket Books or something like that. One of my novels was number one. I knocked Grisham off the top of the list in the year 2000. Most people think that ebooks started in 2008 when Kindle came out, and right. Now it's not the case. I was so tired of them, I didn't want anything to do with it. But a couple good friends convinced me that this was the real time now. The sky really was changing. And I got on board, and that brought me back. I was playing professional poker at that point. I was, you know, writing a couple books a year for hire. But at that point in time, I'd gone off and was playing professional poker and making really good money and having a blast. But here comes the indie movement and sucked me back into publishing and writing. And I've done another 100 books now in indie, 100 novels, not counting all the other books.
You know, all the other stuff to do. I want to get into the prolific nature of your writing, but I want to go back to why you had so many different pseudonyms. What was the reasoning behind having to do that back in the day?
Well, back in the day, you know, publishers had this thought that they could only publish one book from an author, or maybe two books a year. I was writing between 13 and 15 novels a year. And these were the, you know, full 70 to 90 to 110,000 word novels. So I had to have many publishers. It just was the nature of the beast. And I had to have many names. And then so it just was, again, that nature of the breaks that traditional publishers seemed to think that they couldn't promote more than one or two books. In romance, you could have three or four. But in science fiction, you had to have one. In mystery, you had one or two. And I was writing in all those genres under, so it had to be multiple names. Now, as an indie author, everything's under Dean Wesley Smith, just everything. Right. I've tried to pull everything back in, have no pen names, no reason to have a pen name unless you're writing erotica and young adult, then you probably want to keep those two apart.
Now, you've applied so many of your personal passions and experiences into genres. You're not just a science fiction and fantasy and mystery writer. No. You're Westerns, right? You got the Poker Boy mysteries.
Mm-hmm. What am I missing? Actually, the mysteries on our Cold Poker Gang, which is retired detectives in Las Vegas who are solving cold cases. And I think I've got like 10 or so books in that series and a few short stories. Poker Boy started a long time ago, and that's a sort of a fantasy series okay. where Poker Boy is he solves cases and solves problems by asking stupid questions. Pretty much my life.
I could be on his team, apparently.
Yeah, exactly. Pretty much, you know, me writing about my wish fulfillment, you know, and his superpowers are kind of ramped up, poker powers just ramped up a little bit, observation, things like that.
Okay. Yeah, because that was something at the last workshop. Now, you and I, I've had the honor of getting to teach alongside you and Christine Catherine Rush.
No, you're our third. You're our anchor. We need you.
Thank you. It is an honor to be to sit alongside you, wonderful giants of the industry. You had said something at the last WMG workshop in Vegas when I was sitting beside you, and I remember writing it down because it stuck with me. And it was something that you said, and it was about the manuscript itself and the format and the reader. And you talked about when you were playing poker that you weren't playing the cards, you were playing the other players, and you adapted that into writing. I'd love to hear a bit about that.
Yeah, I do that. There, I have a lecture called The Stages of Fiction Writers, and it dawned on me one day when I was sitting at in a poker tournament. And, you know, and it was actually some high level players that were there, and Eric Seidel and a couple others. It was in the World Series of Poker. And I'm sitting there and I'm not paying any attention to the cards that I have. I'm only paying attention to what the other people think I have. And that's what happens at a certain stage early on as a writer, stage one, stage two. All the writers care about are grammar and, you know, making sure their sentences are pretty and, oh my God, they don't want to upset their workshop or something stupid like that. You know, and that's all they care about are the sentences. When you get to the next level where you start selling, you know, regularly out there to magazines and other places, what occurs is that you're paying attention to the story and the character. So you've moved up a level and you're paying attention to, you know, whether things work together or what like that. And you're paying some attention to the readers also on the other side. There's always readers on the other side of these screens. And then the fourth level, the stage four writers, the ones that are doing it, been doing it for a long time and have it under control. We don't care about the grammar and the spelling. We only thing is our words are to be used by us to tell a story to the readers. So we don't care, which is why beginning writers will think someone like a Clive Cussler can't write, even though he sells millions of copies. You know, it's just, they can't even see what Cussler is doing. It's that my analogy is that watch a couple chess masters play a game of chess. And if you're a beginning chess player, you have no idea what they're doing. Right. That's exactly what beginning writers looking at a Grisham or a King or a Cussler or a Nora or, you know, people like that. You can't see what they're doing. You just can't see it. But you will if you keep writing and getting a lot of books out and keep learning and, you know, learning on everywhere you can, you'll eventually get to that level. But it's, you know, it's a craft, you know, and those folks are the masters. That's the bottom line. You know, stage four writers. There's a lot of stage four writers out there. Yeah. Stage four poker players. That's just basically they couldn't. You don't care. I mean, I played many, many, many thousands of hands of poker. Never looked at my cards. Never once looked at my cards. Didn't even care. All I cared about is what the other person thought I had.
Right. Right. And that's what you're playing. So yeah. that kind of is an interesting parallel to one of the workshops you teach and even a book of the same name, Writing Into the Dark. Mm-hmm. What is Writing Into the Dark?
That's trusting yourself. Trusting yourself as a writer. You have been absorbing stories since you were a baby. All of us have, you know, especially if, you know, we were lucky and parents read to us and everything else. We've been absorbing stories. So we already have it all, you know, in our heads. Our learning process as a writer is to knock down all of the critical voice blocks that are stopping that stuff from coming out. You already have the same techniques and the same knowledge that any writer has. You just don't know how to access it and get it out of your creative voice and back. So writing into the dark is not outlining, not thinking ahead about the story, just sitting down and writing the next sentence and then the next sentence and letting your characters go where they're going to go, you know, and that's why, you know, you back in the day you used to hear a lot of major writers say, oh, the characters took over. You know, it's like, well, yeah, that's what they do. You follow the characters until the story's done. And that's it. It takes an enormous amount of confidence in the process because right. beginning writers don't believe they can write. And so therefore they have all this critical voice that stops them from accessing all of their actual skills. And so the learning process in writing is just knocking down one roadblock after another until you can access what's already inside of you.
Okay. Excellent.
That's what it is. Just write. You start it off. I start with titles on novels. I'll start with a title, start down, start typing. And anywhere from 40 to 70,000 words later, a book is done.
You're finished.
I have no idea where it's going anywhere. I'm always like, oh shit. But I never allow myself to try to think ahead. I just write the next sentence and see where it goes.
So you have, continually. So WMG Publishing, you've got that for imprint to re-release some of your stuff, to release some new stuff. You also have magazines that you're publishing there. And one of them was Smith's Monthly, where not only were you releasing a full magazine every month, but you were writing a short novel for every issue.
Yeah, just a, you know, regular size novel, 40 to 50,000 words, and for every issue monthly. Did that for 44 straight months before Chris got sick. That period, Chris got sick, and then we had to move to Vegas, and then Allison got sick, and the business. And so I'm bringing it back now. I've got 5 issues basically in the pipeline, but I got 44 issues in 44 months. Actually, I think it took 46 months as it sort of drained there at the end when Chris was right. getting sick. And then I'm going to bring it back with issue 45. And they're fun. I got one here. The last one that came out had the novel Burn Card, which is one of my poker. But yeah, it's a regular size magazine, two column.
You know. Well, I'm actually, and since we're doing show and tell, I've got the latest issue of Pulp House. I just got in the mail, which is another thing. So you and Chris had were publishing Pulp House magazine back when I was starting writing. It was my dream to one day maybe get you to look at a story of mine if I was lucky. It went away, but then you brought it back. Can I hear just a little bit about that? Because you did it differently back in the day than
yeah,
you.
Yeah, we started Pulp House Publishing, the company, in 1987. That's how long Chris and I have been around and been together. And it was a hardback magazine, and meaning it was an anthology made out of hardback. And leather, some of them were signed. We have the leather editions of Pulp House that had every author in every volume signed it. Mm-hmm. That was the trick. And those are slipcased and quite expensive.
Yeah, worth a lot of money, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah, we did. We did 250 of those alone. We built that company off of starting that. We had a novella line. We had a short story author collection line called Author's Choice. We had short story paperbacks. We were way out ahead of the curve of the indie movement in 1987 to through 1992. Actually, we closed it down in 96, but that was Pulp House Publishing. And when Chris got the job editing FNSF magazine, we were basically done with the 12 issues. We had 11 of the 12 done, and she went off to edit FNSF magazine. So we wanted to keep Pulp House magazine going. So I moved it to magazine and became the editor. And I was the publisher of Pulp House. I became the editor of Pulp House magazine. And I did about 20 issues of that before we shut the company down. And so that was the one thing we wanted to bring back. And I always wanted to bring it back. And when we started up WMG, WMG bought the assets of Pulp House Publishing and took it in under WMG. And then we finally, I guess it was like 3 years ago now, brought Pulp House back. And it's been quarterly. And now you are, yeah, there's a lot of
and got every new issue.
Yeah. And now we're doing a thing with you. We had you edit an issue. We're going to be doing a special section of every issue, and we're going to, after this phase of the world is done, we're going to go to 6 issues a year. Right. So we're increasing speed, and Mark's going to be, you're going to be doing the, a guest editor spot for two or three stories.
After you asked me and I passed out and I got up again and you guys brought me back.
He's the only person on the planet I would ever trust to guest edit.
Very, very kind of you.
We did this once back in the early edition, and the guest editor was the Grandmaster Damon Knight.
Wow.
He was the only one who's ever guest edited besides me on Pulp House. Mark's now coming on board as a guest editor too, to get a little bit of, I mean, otherwise it's just my taste all the time. Right. Got to have his taste too. And he knows what a Pulp House story says.
And so Pulp House is cutting edge of modern short fiction. You don't call it speculative fiction. You don't call it whatever, because you kind of go with whatever just feels right.
Is that right? It crosses genres. We also have reprints in it because I believe that a story doesn't spoil. And, you know, and there were some great stories that we published back in 1988, 1999, and 2001 that are fantastic stories that, you know, no one's seen for 30 years. Right. And it's like, so we bring those back. Pulp House has to have a twist. It has to be, think of it as Twilight Zone, a little off kilter.
A little off kilter, okay.
Yeah, and, you know, a little messed up.
No, I think Kent Patterson's one of those authors that definitely a Pulp House style author.
Yeah, I mean, Kent's the only one that can write a, well, he died back in the mid-90s from polio, another epidemic. One of the things that Kent wrote was a story basically about, it was a Western story about cowboys, and they had a stampede, but the stampede was Spuds, Idaho Spuds, and he had to save the Idaho Spuds. He got away, and it worked. It's a great story. It's absolutely memorable. If you ever read it, it's called Spud Wrangler.
And you brought that back in the latest incarnation of
it, I think we put it in issue zero, actually. Okay, of Pulp House, you know, along with people like Nina Creaky Hoffman way back in the day, wrote a story called Savage Breasts, where a woman's breasts sort of take over. You know, you just pulp out stories.
Strange stuff.
So yeah, you'll know them when you see them.
Now, because you and Chris have worked in traditional publishing and indie publishing for so long, mm-hmm. and you know so much and you're so giving and you're sharing, you guys do workshops. Now, we talked about the workshops in Vegas that I've been privileged to participate in. But I mean, right now, obviously, people cannot go to be in person. We've got to keep our distance. And so... But you've always run these online workshops. Can you talk a little bit about the online workshops that you guys are doing?
Well, not always, because a couple people had to drag me kicking and screaming to online. And there wasn't anything like Teachable or anything when I started. I had to kind of invent my own website to do this.
Right.
And but now we're on teachable.com. And you can find them under deanwesleysmith.com there. You can find... list all the workshops we have. We started off and I said, well, I'll do this for a half a year. I'll do these couple workshops for a little while. It turns out that was almost 20 years ago now. And because we were doing the Dean and Chris show and we were doing some, you know, craft workshops, you know, locally in Lincoln City, Oregon, where we used to live. And it just sort of kind of kept going. And every year I would do more and do more, and then the old ones would still be there. And then if it got dated, I would take it off. And now it's, I mean, there's, you know, enormous amounts of workshops up there. There's enormous amounts of lectures. There's things called pop-ups, which are, you know, 10 to 12 videos about a topic that we just think it's important right now. And we just pop it up. We have classes, like there's a class called Shared Worlds. Basically I'm writing a novel which will be the Bible for this shared world.
Right.
There's another class called Licensing Transition, how writers can start thinking from being a writer to being a licensor, and things like that. So we have everything up there, and we have monthly regular workshops that last 6 weeks a month. And, those are monthly.
That's so fantastic.
Everything's there. And we're doing a special starting tomorrow.
Ooh, wait, this is breaking news. Wait,
yeah, breaking news. We did this back in March, and we did a, it was sort of when this whole thing started. It was almost a month ago now, right. And they had canceled March Madness, and we knew people were going to be inside and all that. And so we called it March Sadness Special. And for 48 hours, we basically, made everything on Teachable, everything, all of them, even the lifetime subscriptions, we made them half price. And thinking that this was going to be over in a few weeks. Remember, right, a lot of us thought back then that this would kind of go, well, it's not over yet. Here we are in the middle of April, and it's not over, and it doesn't look like it's going to be over for a little while yet. So, and a lot of people missed those 48 hours because we didn't publicize it very well. We just decided to do it. And to try to help writers be focused on learning while they're stuck at home like we are. And although stuck at home for a writer is a normal day. But, you know, the reality is we thought, let's do this again, because a lot of writers missed it. So starting tonight on my blog, it'll be at midnight tonight. We're going to do what a special called Spring Training. Spring Training will be, again, for 48 hours, where everything on Teachable is half price, everything on Teachable. And so it's going to be, you know, if you can jump in and a workshop you wanted to take but couldn't quite afford or something like that, it's all going to be there, only 48 hours. And then, knock on wood, we'll never have to do this again.
Right.
We get through this whole world crisis and get to the other side, and we'll just keep going. This is the first time ever we've ever discounted workshops, except we discount them slightly in Kickstarters when we're doing them, but never sense. Half price except for that one in March and now this one in April. We figure the world.
You had something Kickstarter. You had a Kickstarter Teachable program, didn't you?
No. We always do our Teachable workshops in Kickstarter. We kind of add them as an offer, as a reward.
Oh, so people get access to them.
They can get in a little cheaper.
Early access and a little bit cheaper than normal. Okay.
So yeah, like $300 workshops, $250 if it's in a Kickstarter, and you can get credit and stuff. And really again, cool. If you buy these things half price, you don't have to use them right now. You can use them whenever, you know, credits last forever on Teachable for us.
And so One of the things that you've been very adept at or very good at is changing with the times, obviously changing the way you're selling fiction, working with different publishers. You've written a lot of media tie-in novels as well, Star Trek novels, Men in Black, all of those things as well, done your own stuff. One of the things from the last workshop I was at in person was when you and you mentioned it briefly, is thinking about yourself as not necessarily the book, but you start with you as the author brand and you think about your IP, and a book is merely one way.
Yeah, the book is, that's the new kind of way of, Chris and I went to the licensing expo, which has been going on since the early 90s. And if I'd have known that, I'd have been richer than I am already. But the reality is we always, it's sort of a mind shift in the way that back in history, human beings used to think that the planet Earth was the center and everything rotated around the planet Earth. The whole, you know, the sun went around and everything went around. Well, the difference is writers now think their book is the center and everything rotates around their book. In reality, it's the intellectual property is the center and the book is just a planet rotating around the intellectual property. The gaming rights, all the other rights are all just planets rotating around this intellectual property. You have to understand copyright before you really start to grasp that. But a book is just a planet off of it. And then all the things you can do off of the books, the electronic rights, the audio, all the different stuff you can do. But, you know, once Chris and I finally got the right thing into the center, everything changed. And we make most of our money off of licensing anyhow. I mean, we right. make nice book sales, but if we had to depend on the book sales, we wouldn't be living where we're living. Right. Book sales are just a very small part of what we do.
Okay.
And workshops are nothing. That all goes to WMG. I get nothing out of the workshops. I just do them to try to help writers.
Excellent. Excellent. Now, we're getting close to the time where I'm going to start popping up some questions from some viewers. So it's going to take you back to that not rewriting, you know, Heinlein's rules, Dean Wesley Smith's rules. And the question is coming from Maddie Dalrymple, who says, what are the factors that distinguishes legitimate story editing from don't rewrite?
Ah, legitimate story editing, copy editing, finding your typos. The moment you start changing anything else beyond typos or beyond a unclear antecedent or something like that, you're rewriting and you're doing it from the front of your brain, which is the critical voice, which is dumber than a post, every one of us. And we do not know what makes our stories good. I don't know what makes my stories good. You don't know what makes your stories good, but you just got to trust it. And so when you write something from creative voice, fix the typos and mail it.
Okay.
Or have a copy editor fix the typos and mail it. Don't let an editor, why would you let someone who can't write into your own work? You're the writer. Grow a backbone and believe in yourself and just trust your stories and put it out. There is no such thing as a perfect story, folks. There just isn't, you know, and you can just stir that pot as much as you want. And all you do is make it worse.
Well, that reminds me of the Fiction River, the anthology workshops that you and Chris host, because I think one of the most critical lessons for writers, can you describe like the process and why that's such a valuable experience?
The anthology workshop?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's because you have six or this year, seven of us sitting up front, seven editors who are buying or might buy with editor opinions. And we're looking at your story out in public in front of everybody. We're not beating stories up. We're not doing that. We're just saying, oh, this works, or I really like this, or this wouldn't be right for my anthology. We're doing that sort of thing. And it makes you realize in very quick order, because all the writers have written six, seven, eight stories this year, I guess is what could have been written. And it just makes you realize that it's just personal taste. I mean, there were a number of times this year, I remember that we went down the row and all of us really liked it until it got to the editor who could actually write a check for it. And then the editor said, no, this just doesn't work for me. And so if you'd have kept that story out into editors and mail, it would have sold on the second or third time out. But a lot of writers, you know, are too afraid because they might get a rejection, you know. Nobody's going to come to your house and shoot you just because you wrote a story that doesn't work for somebody. And, you know, it's just one of those things where, you know, you make up this stuff as writers. Of course, we're trained to make shit up, pardon my French, but we're trained to do that. The reality is then you make it up over in the business world, and that's not where you want to make up stuff. You want to keep it very real in the business part, and you save all of your making stuff up for the fiction part.
Excellent. Thank you. Well, I'm going to pop up another question. Now, this question is from Diaz. It's a first-time writer here. Hey, Diaz, welcome. It says, I have a question. When writing any style, do you have to worry about how you are writing it?
No. No. In fact, that's the worst thing you can worry about. That's your critical voice. The critical voice is the right there on the front of your forehead, the one that is always negative. How you tell the difference between a creative voice and a critical voice? A creative voice is always positive. Always positive. Oh, this will be fun. Oh, let's go do this. Oh, this is fun. Let's try this. It's the two-year-old child going, let's run and take our clothes off and run on the street. That's what you want to access. But your parents, the critical voice, have always said, no, don't do that. No, that won't work. No, people will hate that. And so if you allow that critical voice to write, what you write is boring, dull stuff that's just like everybody else's. That's not what you want to do. You want to allow the true you inside to come out, you know, that two-year-old kid, and let's play, let's go have fun. So how you tell the difference between critical voice and creative voice? Critical voice is always negative, always worried, always afraid you're going to do something wrong. Creative voice is, let's go play. Okay. And so if you can access the let's go play and then have the courage to not touch it, which was the previous question, have the courage to fix the typos and release into the world, you'll be surprised. That was the first question that Mark asked, is what did I learn from that back in the day? Well, I learned that if I just played and released it, I sold. But then for 7 years, I got into the, oh, I better fix it. I better make it perfect. Never sold a thing. It wasn't until I got back to Heinlein's rules where I didn't rewrite, didn't touch anything, just wrote it, fixed the typos, and mailed it, that I started selling again. And now I'm sitting here with 23 million copies of my books in print and 200 novels and, you know, 40-year career. So the reality is the moment you can get past that and start trusting yourself is when you win.
So let's go to, I want to kind of play off of that a little bit and just understand a little bit about where you write, how you write, when you write. Are you longhand? Are you on a keyboard? Do you dictate? Is it late at night, early morning? Like how do you do it?
Yes. I don't write longhand. I'm a keyboard person, but okay. I have a dedicated writing computer, and I would highly recommend everybody do that. I mean, computers are cheap these days. Just get an old computer that the only thing you have on there is like your Word program, and then that is the only thing you do on that. You turn off all the electronic, the emails, the games, the all that stuff. And so when you sit down, why I go this way is my writing computer is over here.
Okay.
And so this is my business computer. I have two other business computers over here. I'm surrounded by computers. And I have my writing computer is over here. So when I sit down at that writing computer, my little voice goes, oh, time to play. And I don't do anything else. Where I'm sitting here, it's business and it's teaching and it's other stuff like that. Okay. And emails. So it's a Pavlovian thing. I'm trained that when I sit there, I write fiction and nothing else. And you can do that with a laptop. You can do that a specific thing. You will be stunned at what that is. So it's just, and I write when I, at this point in time, you know, I'm just sort of all over the place. I used to be a night writer up in Lincoln City because there was nothing to do up there. And basically I would start writing it midnight, maybe 11 o'clock. And, you know, and Chris would go off to bed and I would write till 4 or 5 in the morning. Now I'm kind of an hour here and a couple hours there and a little bit at night and whatever.
Excellent. Yeah. Cool. Thank you. All right. I'm going to bring up the next question. So this question is from Nick via YouTube. And Nick says, what do you think of rapid release? You know, being originally from a traditional background with,
write them as fast as you can write them, as fun as you can do. You know, rapid release, I guess, is a indie term, meaning you save some books up and then put them one out a month. We did that with Chris had a big, huge series in her Retrieval Artist. world. And she had put out a book, and then she put on another one about 6 months later. And then the story was so large that it was in six books, and we released those one a month. And she wouldn't allow them to be released until she was done with the entire story, because she was always fixing things in the previous ones. And so, you know, that was a one a month rapid release. That worked out pretty well. But at this point in time, in this modern world, you need to be prolific. We're back in the pulp era, folks. The world and the history has come around again. And the people who are succeeding in the indie movement are, you know, four books a year, plus some short stories, maybe a collection or two here and there, things like that. I have a challenge on Teachable. In fact, we have three challenges. But one of the challenges is to publish a major something a month, either a novella, a novel, a collection, or an omnibus for 12 months. If you sign up on that challenge and actually succeed at publishing one thing a month for 12 months, you get a lifetime subscription.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Wait again. So you kind of win twice.
Well, yeah, actually, you're never losing.
Yeah.
It's $600, I think, to sign up. Yeah. And if you don't make it, you fail somewhere along the way or miss a month, or, you know, like the plague hits and you're not writing or something, what occurs is that $600 goes to workshop credit. So you don't ever lose. You know, you get $600 in learning, you get $600 to do this, and if you actually hit it, then you get a lifetime subscription to any of the choice. We have like four different lifetimes subscriptions.
And even if you only do half of them, you still have
more
assets out there, right?
Yeah. You got six books out, and you get your $600 back in workshop credit.
Fantastic.
And so it's a win-win. We have we started 1 year ago. This week, I started what called the Great Challenge, which was write a short story and send it to me every week. And if you made it through 52 weeks, you get a lifetime subscription. I think I have four or five people that have made it through 52 weeks that started back then.
And they ended up with 52 stories they could sell or publish.
They made it through the whole summer. Then they made it through the fall. Then they made it through the Christmas holidays. They made it through sickness. They made it through birthdays. And now they're making it through the plague. And
fantastic.
And yeah, and they're going to, and those people earned those lifetime workshops. Plus they have 52 short stories to market.
That's fantastic. And so, let's go from prolific with people with a big catalog and lots of IP that they can leverage. Let's take a look at a question. Yeah. While you take a drink, I'll read the question.
Yeah, go ahead.
This is from Stacy. Said, for new writers who have only a small list or a small following or limited resources and time, you know, working full time, whatever, what would you recommend focusing on for gaining new readers? Obviously, besides, you know, writing a good story.
Well, you can't think about writing the best story possible, because that's going to put you into perfect mode, and that's going to put you into all that rewrite crap, and you'll write nothing but pablum.
Okay.
Trust me, as a longtime editor, I mean, I've been editing since the 80s. As a longtime editor, I can see a story a mile away that was rewritten to death. That's not what I want to see. I want to see the stories. Think of a polished rock and a regular rock. You find a beautiful rock on the beach, and it's unique, it's different, it's got edges, it's got sparkles, it's got stuff, and then you throw it in a thing and polish it to death. What does it look like? It looks like every other polished rock. And that's what editors don't buy, sameness. We buy different. And so that's the key with that, is you got to let your stories be different. I know that takes courage, but you got to let your story stay different. Okay, what was that question again?
Oh, sorry, let me bring it back up.
How do you do it when you got when small?
Yeah, if you don't have a lot of assets, right?
You won't like my answer.
Uh-oh.
I'm sorry. You just won't. Have some patience. This is a long-term career. Okay. Keep learning. Write more. Put it all out. Write the next thing. Just keep writing. You can't do any promotion will do you nothing as a beginning writer or with two or three. There's a magic number around 20 books, 20 major books, like a collection or a novel or novellas that are standalone and out around the world, not in Kindle Select, but around the world, that will make all the difference. There's a magic number in there where there is a discoverability that comes in. And once you get past that magic number, so if you've only got a few things, take a deep breath, keep learning how to be a better writer. Don't try to polish your stories into better writers. Just keep going to classes and studying other writers and reading how to write books and things like that. And then write more. Just write more. And eventually you'll get there. You really will. But you gotta just be patient and keep writing.
Thank you. And now let's go to writing more. So Jeremy asks, what is a good daily word count for someone who wants to make a living as a writer? Oh, and I'm going to let you answer that while I go answer the door because I'm home alone.
Go for it. What's a daily word count? I'll tell you, I've been friends with some of the great writers of all time and with a lot of major writers now. And there doesn't tend to be an average. What is the average is they all produce. We all produce words pretty much every day. Now, if you want to be as prolific as I am by and large, I'll do about 120 to 140,000. Well, that was quick. 120 to 140,000 words a month is my average thing. But that is what I call consumable words. Like, for example, my blog, I do a blog every day on DeanWesleySmith.com. Sometimes they're deadly dull, and sometimes I'm doing something like talking about my day or talking about workshops, or sometimes I'll get on a soapbox and go off on a soapbox. You never know what you're going to get at my website. Thank you. But by and large, I would say, Fred Pohl, the Grandmaster Fred Pohl, he basically would not come out into the world until he had his 1,000 words done. And he did that for decades. Wow. 1,000 words a day, day after day, produces a lot of stuff. But I consider anything I produce that is consumed by the public. So I don't count letters. I don't count emails,
right?
Things like that. But I count my blog posts and fiction. And I'll do between 120 and 140,000 words a month. So I'm up at like pulp speed 3.
Wow. Okay. Thank you. Thank you for that. I had to answer the door because the dogs were going crazy and I wouldn't have been able to turn my mic back on. So another question here. I'm going to pop up. This is from Vijay. Vijay says, I've been writing Indian romance and mystery stories for Western audiences with little success for the past 7 years. Do you suggest anything to accelerate my book sales? It's going to be difficult to answer because we don't have details. How many books, right?
Yeah, it all depends on numbers of books, making sure you're wide around the world, which I would assume you are, and just keep learning how to write better stories. Keep working on that. Probably what stops sales? I'll tell you, there's three things that stop sales. And okay. And beginning writers tend to not want to hear any of these, I'm known for being blunt, as Mark well knows. And so it's always gutsy to have me on one of these things, especially live.
So but, live, unedited, I can't bring up censor.
Yeah, he can't go, no, stop that. Number one, your covers suck. That could be the case. You're not imitating your genre. You may not know your genre. That just takes,
I have made both those mistakes.
You know, all of us have. And I have a series, my Thunder Mountain series. I mean, it's science fiction, is historical Western, and it's romance. And, and
everyone should love it.
Yeah. I put a horse's ass on every one of the covers. That's what we decided. That was the branding we were going to do.
The spaceship.
There's always a horse's ass on every one of the covers. I'm not kidding. Go look at any of my Thunder Mountain books. There's a horse's ass on the cover. But the reality is that you have to have these covers branded to a genre, right? Theoretically. You need to have your covers look professional. You need to have your copy, your sales copy. Now, you may think you're writing good sales copy, but if there's a passive verb in it, you're not. If you're giving too much plot, you're not. If you're not telling the reader what they're buying versus the plot of what they're buying, you're not. You're not writing good sales copy. And so the reality is that you just don't know. The third thing that keeps you from not selling is your openings. You know, you don't do depth. You don't pull the reader into a setting. You don't get the readers down inside of a character's head. Because think about if you're standing in a bookstore, which is, I know, unusual these days, but you look at the cover grabs you, you read the blurb on the back, and you go, oh, that's interesting, and you open it up and read the first paragraph or two, or the first page. Those are the three things that will stop you. And in electronic books, it's even worse. The cover's got to catch, the blurb's got to be not all plot heavy and passive and dull, and then the first lines, that you've got to be able to pull the reader down until they go, oh, I want to buy that, and they go and buy it. So if you're not selling a lot and you've got more than 20 or 30 books out that are major, not just short stories, but books, then I would go analyze those things. Blunt. I'm blunt. I'm sorry.
Oh, no. That's fantastic. It's fantastic advice. I just popped up some comments while you were chatting because we've only got about less than a minute to go.
Oh.
We have a question that we weren't able to answer from Tamara. Do you
recommend publishing standalone? Yes. Publish your standalone short stories. It helps. It's discoverability.
Awesome.
And put them in collections on top of that. Yes,
use them as much as possible. As a matter of fact, I have a book about that I co-wrote with Maddie Dalrymple, but we're not going to get into that right now.
That's a good book.
So, Dean, thank you so much for taking the time to hang out with me today, for having some fun. Yeah. I think this one, Jamie says this was the best spotlight yet. Obviously, I enjoyed the bluntness and the horse's ass and all the fun things that we talked about. Thank you again. Have a fantastic day. And thank you guys for watching and listening to the DDD Spotlights. We'll be back again tomorrow at 1 p.m. Thank you, Dean.
Thanks. Bye.
That's it for this week's Self-Publishing Insiders with Draft to Digital. Be sure to subscribe to us wherever you listen to podcasts and share the show with your will-be author friends. And start, build, and grow your own self-publishing career right now at DraftToDigital.com.